Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there. On top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Tonight, the regular CrimeWire team are all absent for various reasons, and manning the show tonight are myself, Kim Colton, CrimeWire Director of Research, Delilah of Imagine Publicity and Administrator of the Victims' Rights Blog, Time's Up, and esteemed prosecutor, Donna Pendergast, who is also a regular consultant for the CrimeWire team. Welcome, everyone.
Glad to be here, Kim.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I think tonight we're going to start off with our first segment here, and that is the Molly Bish case. Our first case tonight is the June 27th, 2000 disappearance and subsequent death of 16-year-old Molly Bish in Warren, Massachusetts. Molly's mother dropped her off that morning at Commons Pond, the local swimming hole, where the high school junior had just started a summer job as a lifeguard. When swimmers arrived 20 minutes later, the only traces of Molly were her water bottle, sandals, a police radio, and an open first aid kit. Molly had vanished. The ensuing search for Molly became the most extensive in Massachusetts history. Molly's story was told on America's Most Wanted, 48 Hours, Court TV, Unsolved Mysteries, Larry King, Nancy Grace, and other national and local media outlets. But in spite of everyone's best efforts, Molly's fate remained a mystery for three long years. And then in June of 2003, the search for Molly came to a heartbreaking end when 26 of her bones were found scattered on the side of a mountain only 5 miles from her home. Molly was buried on her 20th birthday. No arrests have been made, and the case remains unsolved. Our guests tonight are Molly's sister, Heather Bish, as well as the ex-wife of a suspect, Rodney Stanger, Deborah Stanger. So, Heather, I'd like to throw this to you just to start off our segment. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about Molly, what Molly was like, and describe her for our listeners?
Absolutely. My sister was 16 years old when she was abducted from her lifeguard position. My father often described her as, everybody had a Molly. She played three sports. She was on the honor roll. She was never truant from school. She was silly. She was goofy. She was fun. She got along with everybody. We came from a small town, so there was, maybe 70, 80 people in her graduating class, and she sort of just, kind of bounced through the cliques. She didn't have a certain crowd that she hung around with or, stayed with. She was kind of friends with everybody.
And Heather, can you tell us, this summer job as a lifeguard, was this Molly's first job?
Well, Molly had actually been working at an ice cream stand in the next town over for you know, probably that whole summer before. My brother had been a lifeguard at this pond the three previous years. He had gone on. He was in college, and he wanted to get some experience building houses. Molly had trained all winter long to become a lifeguard, just like her brother. She played soccer like my brother. You know, she very much wanted to be like him and followed in his footsteps to become a lifeguard. She took over that position. John trained her, and she was actually on her eighth day of work when she was abducted.
And could you tell our listeners, describe this pond and this beach that she worked at? I mean, was this an actual beach, or was it a swimming hole? And what was the routine for Molly once she arrived there in the day, as best you know?
It's small. Like I said, we live in a very small town. We don't lock our car doors or our house doors. Everybody knows each other. Very often they're related. It's even though it's a small town, where Cummins Pond is located is down a dead end street. It is a sort of a mother's beach where young children and mothers will take their children for swimming lessons, but it's also a place well known for fishing. So it's down a dead end street, but it's not advertised. There's not a sign for Cummins Pond. It's actually not a well known or well populated beach for the townspeople. It's just a sort of a convenient little pond that, you know, that some people would go to in the area. And Molly's routine was she would actually stop at the police station on her way into work and pick up the police radio. Where she was at the pond, there isn't any cell phone reception, and because at the time there was only one lifeguard, that was the only form of communication. So she would pick up the police radio. My mother would proceed to bring her to the pond, which is only about half a mile away, and she would go down to this little shed where she'd get her first aid kit and the beach chair. They hadn't even gotten a real lifeguard chair yet there. She was still using just a small beach chair. And she would set up, you know, the lifeguard kit in front of her chair and put her feet up and try to get some sun. That's basically what she did each day. The thing that was different for Molly than my brother was my brother would usually go for a morning swim and do a few laps. Molly, in fact, didn't really like to swim in that pond. She was more of a pool swimmer and felt like, you know, it was kind of gross with the squishiness and the fish and all of that. So she didn't typically swim in the pond, you know, unless there were children there to play with or, you know, she was being protective.
Okay, go on.
I was just going to, this is Delilah. I just wanted to ask Heather, how about, on a typical day, about how many people would be at the pond when Molly got there?
Actually, virtually no one. Unless there was a couple stray fishermen. You know, she got there around 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, between 9:30 and 10, depending on, but generally more towards 10, and didn't see people until the next hour or 2 hours. And, you know, it probably maybe had 30 people that would come on the busiest day of summer. It just wasn't well populated. In the next town over, there's actually a lake beach that's a little bigger and a little more well-known and, you know, much closer to the center of town and much more popular.
Heather, can you tell us how your family got word that something unusual had occurred, that Molly had disappeared and wasn't at the beach? How did that all come down?
Sure, absolutely. My mother had dropped Molly off about 8 minutes before 10 and, you know, kind of proceeded on home. Then we had gotten a phone call around 1 o'clock that afternoon. And they had said that Molly wasn't at her, the police had said that she's not at her lifeguard position. Did we know where she was? My mother said, well, I brought her there this morning. That doesn't make any sense. She must be there. And so my mother immediately became nervous. She just had that bad feeling because of the man in the white car, which I can talk about in a short bit. But
yeah,
immediately had a bad feeling and raced into the car, calling me on the way and saying there's something wrong. Molly's not at the beach. You know, I kind of thought it was funny, but I wrestled my 10-month-old into the car and said, okay, Ma, I'll follow you down there. By the time I got to the center of town, which is on the way to the lake, to the pond. She was already rushing back, saying there's something absolutely wrong. Molly's not there. Her shoes are there. You know, and she was very panicked, and that's when we went into the police station. And when we went into the police station, the police on duty said, oh, well, you know, she's probably just with her friends. And I said, but she didn't have her shoes on. You know, what teenage girl do you know that walks around without her shoes on, generally? So then I asked them if they had gone to her friend's house, and they hadn't. So we were very alarmed at that point.
And Heather, too. Well, I was just going to say, and Heather, she was very, I know she was very conscientious. She wouldn't just walk off and to talk with her friends, or not, let alone not without her sandals, but it's just something that was not her at all.
Absolutely.
Correct?
Not. Molly, in fact, it was the first day of swimming lessons, and she was very conscious of, aware of this, and felt very sort of a little nervous to make sure that she was making sure everybody was safe and the kids were going to be okay. So she was particularly conscientious of this day. So we know she absolutely would not walk away.
Heather, let me ask you this. You made a prior reference to the fact that that your mother had a concern because of something she had seen the day before, and all of a sudden that started to take on a new significance in light of Molly's disappearance. Can you describe for our listeners what you were talking about?
Sure. On the Monday before Molly disappeared, the day before, my mother had dropped her off at the pond, and there was a man in a white car sitting there smoking. And Molly sort of hopped out and hugged my mom and went on to get her stuff and get ready. And my mom just looked at this man, and he was just sitting there smoking, and he had this look of arrogance on his face, and it just gave my mom a feeling of uneasiness. So she hopped out of the car and thought, oh, I'm going to go up there and talk to Molly and make sure this guy leaves. He didn't appear to be fishing or doing anything. He was just sitting there smoking. And she thought that was odd in the morning. So she went up and talked to Molly and asked her about how she felt about safety. And actually Molly said, Mom, it's just fishermen, just fishermen. You don't need to worry. So my mom actually went back to the car, and the man was still there. So she gave him sort of what she describes as a teacher's stare. My mother's a second grade teacher, so she specializes in one of those kinds of looks, and kind of rustled around in her car, pretending she was looking for something, and then the man in the white car left. At the time, she thought, oh, maybe I'm being paranoid, and not, you know, this isn't anything. So she didn't get a license plate. She didn't pay as much attention as maybe she, you know, wanted to and had hoped to at this point.
Heather, and I'm going to move to Deborah Stanger in just a minute, but I have a few last questions just to kind of wrap up your side of this. Molly disappeared. There was a massive manhunt, as I indicated at the beginning summary. Can you tell our readers, you can tell I'm a blogger. Can you tell our listeners, you know, ultimately, was Molly discovered and how that all came about? I mean, I alluded to it, but maybe you can give a little bit more detail on that.
Well, actually, it was by chance. A hunter had been hunting that previous fall and came across a blue bathing or a piece of blue cloth. He happened to be sitting that May in a bar with a man who was very familiar with Molly's case. He had personally researched the Holly Peranian case, which is a similar case in a nearby community of a young girl who disappeared unsolved, and became very alarmed because he knew the details of Molly's case and knew that Molly was not wearing a typical orange lifeguard bathing suit, that she was in fact wearing a blue bathing suit. So he said, you need to take me up to this spot right away. And they went up the next day, found the piece of cloth, alerted the police, which then alerted the state police, and from there, the massive, in fact, the largest search in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts was orchestrated. It was very unique because it was a grid-by-grid search over 500 acres and orchestrated by the forensic anthropologist out of the medical examiner's office. And literally, the state police searched shoulder to shoulder, and they were able to recover 26 of Molly's 206 bones.
And this location where her bones were located, how far is that from the pond, roughly?
Within the 5-mile radius and within 2.5 miles from our home.
Okay. And Before I talk to Deborah Stanger, because I want to talk about, just so our listeners understand, can you tell them how long after Molly disappeared before these bones were discovered?
3 years. She was, they were able to identify Molly on June 9th of 2003, which was roughly 3 years to the day she disappeared.
Okay.
And Heather, I just wanted to ask now, I noticed on the composite, one thing that kind of stuck out with your mom, and that is included in the composite, is the way this man held his cigarette when he was sitting in the car smoking it. It was a little unusual. It was a two-fingered stiffness, almost a European way of holding it. And
right.
Different that it was even on the composite, and I think that'll come in later, Donna, when you're speaking with the importance of that'll come in later with when you're speaking with Deborah, and I just wanted to throw that out there. Okay,
and Heather, before I move over to Deborah, and I may go back to you, but let me ask you this. As I understand it, some 9 years after Molly's disappearance in 2009, there was basically a little bit of a media uproar because a possible potential suspect was discovered. Can you tell our listeners what your family knew of that?
Well, we had received a call to our foundation office notifying us about a lead that had been given to the police already. And, you know, this has happened quite a few times over the years. And quite honestly, we didn't think much of it. And, you know, I kind of took it and called my private investigator, Tom Shamshak, and said, hey, do you mind looking into this? I don't know if it's anything, but, it was just something that came in that kind of sparked us a little bit. And from there, generally when he gets a lead, which is the nice part about having a private detective on a case, when you're dealing with law enforcement, generally they don't sit down and talk to you about each lead that they get or each person that they're looking into in depth, where a private investigator can sort of walk you through a case and tell you how things are being handled and why things are being, you know, why a person might be crossed out of the mix or why they might look good or how things are figured. So they really hold your hand through an investigation. So we've been very grateful to that. But we were so Tom started to look into this lead and just kept, as he was digging, he just kept getting more and more information that tied Ronnie Stanger into Molly and Holly Peranian's murder. There was just new developments. His brother lived in the area. They were from the area. He had a girlfriend that lived in Warren. He'd fished at Cummins Pond. He hunted where Molly was found. And he had access to a work car. So those pieces really just started to add up. And he's really been the best lead we've had thus far in the case.
Okay. Deborah Stanger, I'm going to throw it over to you. The name of your ex-husband, Rodney Stanger, has come up as a possible suspect. I'm sorry, as the sister of Crystal Morrison, who was married to or was the girlfriend of Rodney Stanger for 20 years. Deborah, can you tell us a little bit, starting off, about Rodney Stanger and what you know of him?
Well, he's very manipulative. He's cunning at times. There's something to... He was very sadistic. It didn't matter whether it was a child, a woman, an animal. You know, it was just, they were possessions, they were things.
All right, and as I understand it, Deborah, your sister was involved with Mr. Stanger in a relationship for some 20 years. Did you have any indication during that relationship that he had tendencies towards violence?
Oh, yes. He physically abused me during our marriage. He abused the children. That's why I left when he started on the children. I just ended up going into a battered woman's shelter. I took the kids and left.
All right. So your relationship, I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. You were actually married to Mr. Stanger.
Yes.
All right. You're his first wife, and then he was involved
no,
after
I'm
your
second.
Okay, you were his second wife, and
yeah.
then after you, he was involved with Crystal Morrison for some 20 years. Do I have that all straight now?
Pretty much. The timing might be a little off, but yeah, she was with him for a very long time.
Okay. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about what happened to Crystal Morrison and her ultimate fate?
All I know is that he ended up stabbing her over 37 times. And from what her sister told me was that he had locked up the phone and that day, too, so she couldn't call for help.
Okay.
And then I got a call through when I pardon?
I'm sorry. Okay, and Deborah, let me ask you this. So when did the murder of Crystal Morrison occur?
About 3 years ago, I believe.
Okay. And Mr. Stanger has been convicted in that murder?
Yes, he has. I was
okay.
not surprised at all.
Why not?
No, he would and could do that, something like that. He threatened to kill me, too, the day before I left.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And had you ever gotten any information from your sister or heard anything from Crystal Morrison, anything that indicated to you that he may have been involved in the abduction or disappearance of Molly Bish? Did you have any information on that?
Well, I know the people that rented next door to him for 20-something years, they were my friends, and he took them hunting to the same places where where Molly's body was found.
And where
and
was Molly's body found?
I don't know the name of the place, but I know that Detective Shamshak spoke with them, both the hunters that he would go out with, and they told him it was the same place, and they told him about the white car, too.
Okay, and Deborah, do you have any information for us that Mr. Stanger, your ex-husband, was possibly implicated in yet another murder, the murder of 10-year-old Holly Pierina in 1993?
Yes,
case?
I do know his Rodney's brother Randy had a lean-to out in those woods, and he was bringing food to him and stuff. And then his sister lives right on that road too.
So, which road are you talking about?
Where Holly Peranian was.
Okay. He has a connection to that road.
Oh yes. Yes, that's where we got married, as a matter of fact, at his sister's house.
Okay, so right in the same area where yet another disappearance and murder of a young girl occurred.
Yep, and another thing is the stare, the stiff fingers of the cigarettes. I was surprised. I didn't realize that she has a good eye, I'll have to say that. She got it just right, the way he held his cigarettes.
Well, what do you mean by that? Explain that to us, because that seems to be significant to everybody, and I want
yeah.
our listeners to understand
well,
what was unusual about the way he held his cigarette.
Yeah, that's one of the things I noticed first was when I saw that second composite with him smoking the cigarette, because he always held them with the stiff fingers like that. And when I told my friends when I saw the composite drawings, I said, my God, they even got the way he holds his cigarette. Yeah, you know, it looks just like him.
When you say composite drawing, what drawing are you talking about? A drawing that was done based on
Molly
this information?
Go on for Molly Bish's murder, and then I believe there's another one, too. Of you'd have to talk to Tom about that one.
Okay. But there was a composite photo that you looked at, and something about that struck you in regards to...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And Mrs. Bish's comment about the stare. He was like that. Also, the dates. the date Smalley was murdered.
About the date she was murdered?
My daughter, Nina, was born June 25th. We got married on June 28th. So the date's like right in between the two dates.
Because Molly disappeared on June 27th, correct?
Right.
Okay, and do you have any recollection about that date at all, the date in between, where he was, or do you remember?
I was out here in Minnesota. I had left before the murder because I had to protect my daughter from him. He was taking her out unsupervised, and she was coming back a totally different child. So I knew something was wrong. Well, I knew. I tried to tell the judge not to let him take her out.
And are you suggesting that you were fearful that there was some kind of abuse going on with your daughter?
Oh, there was, definitely. She still remembers it.
Okay. And your daughter was how old at that time?
I left. She was 4 years old. This is his daughter. I have another daughter from a previous relationship.
Okay.
But she was four when we left.
Heather Bish, for a minute, I want to throw this back to you. After Molly's disappearance, as I understand it, the Molly Bish Foundation was formed. Can you describe for our listeners exactly what that is and what the Molly Bish Foundation does?
Absolutely. When Molly first disappeared, the police had come to our house and asked us for a head and shoulders picture of Molly that was clear of what she looked like. And being a teenager, she dyed her hair often, had gotten a tongue ring, and Molly was the third child, so it was kind of tricky, actually, to find a picture. By the time my parents, were taking pictures of Molly, they really couldn't even find the camera. So they, you know, we had pictures of her with her friends or prom pictures, but we didn't have a good head and shoulders picture. And we realized that this was probably a common problem with families with multiple children. So after experiencing this and learning that the National Center says 1 in 6 children is recovered with a good head and shoulders picture, we realized that this is very important and significant. So the Molly Bish Foundation was actually born literally on a kitchen table in regard to getting pictures out there of kids and having those and making sure that every family has a good picture that they can keep. And really it's not just that we're afraid someone might experience something to the extent that Molly experienced, but if your child, gets lost at Six Flags or at a country fair, you know, getting that picture out there really prevents them from any further danger. So that's what the primary purpose of the Molly Bish Foundation was, and we've actually identified over 200,000 children across the Commonwealth and New England at this point in the last 11 years. And from there, my parents became very involved with the policy of keeping children safe and were instrumental in bringing Amber Alert to the nation and particularly to Massachusetts. They've been involved with the John Walsh Act being passed and a number of different issues and policies protecting children. We've started the first Missing Children's Day in Massachusetts, and we hold it every year at the State House. And my parents and I travel across the country speaking to law enforcement and just trying to, or different agencies involved in law enforcement and education, and just trying to teach everyone that when a child goes missing, the best thing to do is react swiftly and to overreact. It's better to find Johnny down the road hanging out with his friends than the apparel that Molly had to experience. So we do concentrate our speaking efforts on those two primary messages.
So it sounds like your family is trying to make the best out of a tragedy and make sure some good comes out of Molly's disappearance and subsequent, as it turns out, murder. And I commend you for that. Do you have a website that our listeners can go to look at any information that may pertain to the Molly Bish Foundation?
Absolutely. It's mollybish.org.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Well,
And if I just want to, well, I just wanted to say, if anybody has any information, they could call private investigator Tom Shamshak at 1-800-422-0944.
Great. All right. Well, we need to wrap this segment up. I want to thank our guests tonight, Deborah Stanger and Heather Bish. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for sharing the information that you have on this case. And as always, here at CrimeWire, we are committed to bringing a resolution to some of these cases that have not come to a closure. So keeping it in the news is a good thing. I'm going to turn over to Delilah for our next segment.
Okay.
Yes, and thank you, Heather and Deborah.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
I think it's wonderful what you've done, Heather, and you and your family.
Oh, I thank you. I appreciate your help and your support.
Oh, I'm on your side.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Our next guests are Andrea Pitcher of Stop Child Trafficking and Nevada Assemblyman John Hambrick, and they're going to speak to the topic of child sex trafficking. Something from the Stop Child Trafficking website is that they target the source of child trafficking, the predators who drive the sex industry everywhere in the world, including your own local community. SCT Now looks to sponsors and donors to help fund highly qualified teams of operatives who build packages and execute missions that bring trafficking to a halt. Most other organizations address child trafficking by performing rescue operations, where SCT Now greatly supports their efforts. They believe that for every child rescued, another is going to take his or her place. And not until we stop the predators will we rid the world of trafficking. I'd like to welcome Andrea and John to the show. Andrea, what measures do you think need to be taken how does your organization catch the predator, and how do you get them off the streets?
They go undercover and build cases against the pimps and the buyers, and work with local law enforcement, FBI, and ICE, and they're able to turn over a solid case to the different organizations and stop the demand in trafficking. SCT Now had its first flagship walk in September of 2009 in New York with 40 cities nationwide, and that's where we raised money for the elite teams to do what they need to do. A predator pays as little as $25 for 15 minutes of sex with a child, and for the same amount of money, a four-man team of operatives can be placed on the field to stop them.
Take us through one of your missions. What do you do? Are you able to localize an area or localize a place where a child, where this activity is going on?
And this is what the elite teams do, and they really don't share a lot of that information with us, so it doesn't jeopardize their cases. They're currently doing quite a bit of work in San Diego.
Okay.
Okay.
Are there specific areas that you would target as hotspots?
In Las Vegas? Las Vegas,
well,
Atlanta.
Anywhere. Do you work primarily in Las Vegas, or do you work all over the country?
I work in Las Vegas. I'm a volunteer community ambassador. And I help organize the walk that we have once a year. We just completed our last walk in October, and it was quite successful, with over 250 walkers.
Do you feel that Las Vegas then is a hot spot?
Las Vegas is definitely a hot spot. We're the city of sin. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Mm-hmm. And we are a sex tourist city.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to welcome John Hambrick, the assemblyman. What do you want to add to this conversation?
Well, I think Andrea hit a lot of the major points, but I think if we're going to truly attack this problem, is we have got to make sure that the buyers realize if they come to this town or to this state and they get caught, they are going to be going to jail. They're going to be paying a heavy price financially, and it's going to be publicized. And so these conventionaires and primary conventionaires that come into Las Vegas, they come here and behave like they would not behave in their hometowns, in their small communities. It's going to be changing here. We had a bill last session of our legislature that went after the pimps. Now, hopefully, in this session of our legislature, which will be starting in February, we'll be going adding four more pieces of legislation. One piece is specifically targeting the buyers, and substantially, it's segmented by age, and the younger the victim, the more time. And if you get someone under 14, you could be going to jail for life. So these are messages we've got to send out and kick this little scourge and this little disease down the road. Get it out of our state.
Well, it's John, definitely an epidemic.
And John, I gotta ask you, Donna Pendergast here. You know, I'm sure that some of our listeners are sitting here saying, "Wait a minute, what are you talking about? You mean there are people that go to Las Vegas, or quite frankly, wherever they go, and they're looking to have sex with children? Is that what you're telling us? I mean, explain for our listeners exactly what kind of a market there is out there for this kind of service."
Well, Andrea, do you want to go first? And I'll pick up after, you know.
It's a 30-plus billion dollar.
Because Andrea is on the streets and volunteers. Mine is more legislative. So, Andrea, why don't you go first?
Sure. Yes, there is a demand. And the younger the children are, the more that they pay. And it may be as much as $200 more than they would pay for an adult at the age of 14. And there is a demand. And these girls are trafficked from one city to another, drugged.
And
their innocence is taken.
Them? Can you explain for our listeners? I mean, how does this happen that a child, you know, 14 or possibly even younger, is, you know, a part of some ring that is providing sexual services to, you know, this market that you refer to?
Well, it's because the traffickers, when they come into a convention town, and Las Vegas is, we believe Las Vegas is a national capital, unfortunately. But any larger towns, Atlanta, Miami, New York, and Las Vegas that have conventions, the traffickers or the pimps, whatever word you want to use, will bring in these young women. And we have studies and have tracked a group of young women. And when I say young, it can be as young as 11. We have had victims go before juvenile court judges here as young as 11, and they were prostituted out 10 to 15 times a day. And we tracked a group of 12 for about 18 months, and these young women were prostituted out 10 to 15 times a day, 6 days a week. They averaged between $640,000 and $930,000 in that time frame. The Metropolitan Police Department of Las Vegas have arrested pimps and have seized funds in excess of $500,000. So, yeah, this is a huge industry. And and as Andrea said, and there is Shared Hope, another group, did an undercover investigation where the pimp is on videotape. The pimp is seen negotiating with the camera, with the undercover buyer, and he said, the younger you raise the dollar amount, that means the younger the girl. So there is no misconception. We're not talking about a 17-year-old or 18-year-old that may be dressed up and look like a 25-year-old. They are paying for young girls, and we can't say young women. I respectfully disagree. When you start getting 11, 12, 13, or 14, these are not young women. These are girls. And I don't like the term prostitutes because on the federal level, they're called victims, and that's what they are.
Well, where do these children come from?
A lot of them are runaways or throwaways because of broken homes and single parents, and a lot are kidnapped or sold into trafficking. From the Las Vegas area, we get a large portion coming in from south of the border. We have a large percentage coming in from the Pacific Rim, and the balance will come in from around the country. Blondes from the the Midwest or people in, you know, in the state of Washington, Idaho, Oregon, and they'll migrate because Las Vegas, we always, you know, euphemistically call it Sin City. Well, it will attract people. And just like other any major city, you go to the bus terminals. You can just sit there and stand in a corner and watch. You can see these young women getting off the buses, and you can just see the pimps watching and targeting and going after. It's very visible. And this is not in the back alley.
Yeah.
This is on Main Street. These young women and young girls are trafficked right on the main streets. They're not in back alleys. They don't hide this at all. It's right out there for the public to see.
The pimps are also in the malls and in the schools recruiting. They're recruiting friends. Could very well be a friend of yours, and she asks you to come to a party, and the next thing you know, you're trafficked. Drugs and drugs have been sold.
After the rescues, what types of victim services do you have available in Las Vegas after we're able to pull one of these girls out of the hands of the pimp? And I find, too, I hear a lot of these girls are being arrested for prostitution. Now, is that true? Can they actually arrest a young girl underage for prostitution, or would it be the charge would be trafficking?
Well, the answer is yes to the question on both counts. The victim, the youngster, has to be charged because currently in Nevada state law, if they're not charged, we can't keep them. So they can be charged with prostitution, but the pimp and the seller can be charged with trafficking. So they can both be charged. It's unfortunate in the state of Nevada and most states, if an adult has inappropriate contact with a minor, they can be labeled a pedophile and have records and be labeled for life and have a national reporting data. However, in Nevada, if there's money exchange, that becomes prostitution. And a whole different set of laws will come into play. And so it's unfortunate.
What happens to these young girls that, you know, that are 11, 12, 13 years old and they're arrested for prostitution? And then where do they go from there?
The Department of Social and Family Services here in Clark County, which is the city of Las Vegas, Clark County, will attempt to get these young girls, these victims, back to their homes or their relatives. Now, a lot of them are split homes and they're runaways. They don't want to go back, so we try to find grandparents, aunts, uncles, next of kin of some type. But that's not always the case. And if we can't charge them, they walk out the front door and either the same pimp or another pimp will just pick them up.
Exactly what you're saying, I think, is another epidemic in this country, and that's throwaway kids. And people...
Mm-hmm.
Just really don't. It's hard to wrap your head around to that whole situation, but there's a whole population of kids out there that are termed throwaways because their families don't want to deal with them anymore, or they don't want to go back to a situation in their family that they just can't deal with. So they're out on the streets, living on the streets.
John, I have a question for you. This is Kim Colton.
Yes.
You were saying that it's out in the open for the public to see at the bus terminal and right in broad daylight. I would assume then that the police can see this also. Your thoughts on that, and Andrea, your thoughts too, please.
Well, the police, and we've got an excellent, excellent vice squad here that tries to go after. But keep in mind, when you say prostitution, there's also adult prostitutes. And so the whenever you have larger conventions, and I don't want to name any particular convention or any particular hotel, but keep in mind, if anyone has been on the Strip, you know it's a couple miles, most likely these women and girls are trafficked through a series of things, whether it's a cab driver or other individuals that have contact to people staying at hotels, and they're sold. And just like, you know, you see movies where people are sitting at the bar and they talk to bartenders, they go up to the concierge, they go up to the valet, they go up to this, and you know there's a lot of people that have this knowledge, and for a quick tip some type, you know, $10, $15, $20, $50, $100, they'll say, hey, go here, go there, or call this number, or I'll reach out. And when you come to Las Vegas, you can go into our Yellow Pages, and the outcall escort services have more pages than attorneys. I mean, so, and that's by and large can lead to prostitution. And the pictures you see may not necessarily represent what you're going to be getting. And it's an industry that has all kinds of ramifications besides going after these young women and the adults, and there's involuntary servitude involved. And so it's the problem. It could not only fill one plate, it could probably fill, you know, many, many plates and try to address these situations. And we have to do it through legislation, getting some funding, and come down very hard on the buyers and on the pimps or the sellers. And I'm a retired law enforcement. I did 30 years in federal law enforcement. And I have what we call a beat cop mentality. I can't solve the problem in Cincinnati, but if we here in Nevada, in Las Vegas, Clark County, Reno, which is another convention city, if we can solve our problems locally and drive it out of this state, then as other states and communities see what we're doing, they'll pick up the mantra and they'll do the same thing. And as each community will do this and make it very, very difficult, and with publicity and with jail time and with financial penalties, eventually we will drive it out of the country. But it's not going to happen overnight.
It's in every city across the United States. Sorry.
Go ahead, Andrea.
I said it's in even small cities across the United States, not just the large cities either. Oklahoma, Tennessee, in the Midwest. It's a fast-growing crime.
I think,
Duluth, Minnesota,
you know,
had something a couple months ago with the Somali gangs where they were trafficking any Somali girl under the age of 14. Duluth, Minnesota. So, yeah, it does happen in small communities.
And not only the conventions, it's also the sporting events. And I've been paying attention to the Super Bowl, and Dallas has really picked up a human trafficking task force to fight human trafficking as well. It's in all the major sporting events, fights here in Las Vegas, and you can see it in any casino that you go into.
I live in a resort town too, and it's a small resort town, and we know it's here, but it's not something that you're going to find in any resort town that's going to make the local news every night, because when you depend on a tourist dollars, they don't want to show the bad side, the seedy side of what's going on in the underbelly of your town. Do you find that to be true in Vegas too?
Oh, absolutely. The piece of legislation that I was able to get passed in the last session going after the pimps, I started testimony both in our state assembly and our state senate that many years ago, I'm 65, and when I was a young adult and still living at home, there'd be certain things you start talking about, and your mom and dad would come up and say, we don't talk about such things in polite society. Well, that's the mentality in some of these small communities. We don't want to talk about this problem. We don't mention that. Well, I respectfully disagree. We need to do it. If we're going to stop this problem, we have to open the door, pull back the curtains, let some sunshine and fresh air in, and address the problem head on and very, very severely and very, very quickly. If we don't, what comment does that say on our society or any community that allows this problem, the trafficking of young girls? What, you know, what label will our societies have in history?
And also, I want to make a point that it's not always just young girls. It's little boys, too.
Yes.
Right on up. So it,
absolutely.
There again, it knows no gender. It can
happen
anywhere.
Well, we live
anywhere
in such a culture that pimping is a popular word with the youth.
Yeah.
And they don't see the big picture of it on TV, MTV, Pimp My Ride, My Pimp Cup, and music refers to pimps and working girls, and it seems so glamorous. And here in Las Vegas with the lights and the money, and it's very glamorous on the outside, but underneath it's very dark and ugly and very real.
It is. Yeah, there's a lost, you know, the spirit, it's a lost soul. I mean, you take the spirit and the joy out of these young victims. You know, you don't see them smile and laugh very often.
No, I imagine it's truly unfortunate. I would like to go back to an earlier question. I think I went on to something else. But as far as victim services, where do they go after they're rescued? And, you know, we know that they're arrested. Is the Department of Human Services, do they provide the proper counseling? Do they provide, what do they provide or what don't they provide that they could?
Well, here, and I can only speak about the city of Las Vegas or Clark County. It would be inappropriate for me to address issues somewhere else. But Clark County attempts to address this issue head on. As many other states, we have funding problems now. And hopefully some of the legislation that was passed 2 years ago and those that are pending will be able to get some funny money from the buyers and the pimps to help fund these things to help these young victims. And as Andrea said, young boys are also victims. Vast majority are young girls, but there are young boys. And it would, you think about, you know, I don't want to get too graphic for your audience, but you could have very graphic pictures of what happens and what occurs. But we need to go try to help these youngsters, and it takes a long time and intense psychological, you know, counseling, and hopefully if we can get their families involved, and some of them were throwaways. They can't go back home. They're out there all by themselves, and that's a real tough one to handle. How do you tell an 11, 12, or 13-year-old who was thrown away and they don't have any family that they're on their own? I mean, literally, they're on their own. We have legal remedies to have representation and to have people light them to help these youngsters, but you know they're by themselves, and you know I don't have an easy answer. And social services has this problem, and you know luckily it's not. In the past year, they had roughly 99. Doesn't seem like a lot, but that's 99 people that their spirits have been killed, and it's a difficult problem.
And so what do you think the recidivism is with these children? You know, they've gone through all of the social services, and then do they end up back on the street in the end? A lot of times?
Yeah, yes. The answer is yes, because once they walk out the front door of the courthouse or whatever, the pimp or a pimp is waiting for them. They could communicate with each other. And if they don't have any families to go to, if we can't get them back to, you know, the south of the border, back into the Pacific Rim, Taiwan, the Philippines, Thailand. But if we can't get them back home, what are you going to do? You know, and so they walk out that front door, and they don't know anything else, and they have to survive. And they only know one thing to survive.
So it's you know, that revolving door, vicious cycle type thing, and we're trying to figure out where do you cut it off.
Well, since this is an adult show, cut off. That's a unique euphemism.
Yeah. I didn't mean it that way.
Well, then lack of education or employment skills and a criminal record, and you're not 18
right.
yet.
Yeah. Well, one of the pieces of legislation that I have pending would allow the victims of trafficking, if we can get them out of the sex trade, they can petition the court to have all their arrests and all their convictions vacated, which would give them a brand new start. We could never replace the spirit. That's almost impossible. But we can certainly help them rebuild their lives with a fresh start, that they don't have to look over their shoulders, that somebody said, oh, we're not going to hire you because of this arrest or, you know, this moral character. We have things that we will be addressing, hopefully will allow these young victims as a fresh start as we can get.
It's so sad, John, if I can just for a minute here. It's like, you know, you're talking about victims, and then you're talking about having to give them a fresh start from, you know, the stigma of what has happened to them. I mean, what a tragedy.
It is. It truly is. And there's no easy answer. I mean, if we could look into crystal ball or have some magic concoction, we'd all be millionaires. But this is a human tragedy from many, many shapes and angles. You know, it's such widespread and does such vast damage. We have to attack it from many, many angles.
And the Internet has been a big driving influence. With Craigslist closing down their erotic services section, it just opens up another website.
Yeah, so it makes everything so much more accessible.
Yes.
And it also keeps that network going, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. God love the new internet, the network, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. I did want to ask you, Andrea, about the Haiti quake orphans. I was just flabbergasted when I saw that on your website. A trafficker has actually admitted to selling more than 45 children because, of course, everybody remembers that devastating quake that Haiti had, and there were children. Can you touch a little bit on that, too?
Unfortunately, I can't because I don't follow every story.
Okay.
I really focus in Las Vegas on raising awareness and funds for our special operatives teams. There's so many, there's story after story out there. And
mm-hmm.
I had to really turn away from focusing on each and every one of them because they're so dark and
mm-hmm.
stay mainstreamed in raising awareness and funds
mm-hmm.
for our special operatives teams to build the cases that they need to. And
mm-hmm.
they do a lot like Dateline where they go into the hotel, it's wired, they pretend to be buyers, and they go all the way up the chain until they can take down the whole organization. Currently, I think they've taken down 7. There's 7 cases pending.
And that's just in Las Vegas?
No, that's in the United States. I think the majority of them actually come out of San Diego.
Wow. Well, that's fantastic, though, that they're cleaning up, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. There's information
Donna?
Daily on child trafficking.
Donna, do you have any questions? We're down to our last 2 minutes here.
No, I'm just, as an attorney general at the state level, we don't do a lot of trafficking, although that's something we're looking into these days. You know, or I shouldn't say we don't deal with a lot of trafficking cases.
Okay.
But
mm-hmm.
I just the awareness that we're raising here. To the point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's just a stunning in-your-face awareness, or consciousness raising for a lot of our listeners because they're like, this really happens in the real world, and I think a lot of the prosecutors' offices across the country are saying the same thing, like, wow, this really is an issue. And Andrea and John, I think they're just like, yeah. This happens every day, and I just think it's a really hard concept for a lot of people to get their arms around. So, just bring it to the forefront of public attention, I think, is the first step.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not an easy conversation to have at the dinner table with your family and your kids either. It isn't pleasant by any means. But if it's not talked about, then it's going to be pushed underneath the carpet. And the younger generation, there's a big concern for the younger generation in meeting somebody at the mall and becoming friends. And these traffickers and these pimps groom these girls over a period of time. It doesn't just happen overnight. They become friends. They trust them. They take them to get their nails done. They take them to get their hair done and clothes shopping. And would you just do a favor? And it happens that fast and that easy from the victims that I've met here locally. And I'm a mom. I don't have a degree in crime or anything. I'm just a mom that came across this, and I couldn't even believe that it was real. And I spent about 16 hours on the internet reading it, and that's how I became a volunteer for Stop Child Trafficking Now.
Mm-hmm.
It was very real.
Yeah, when you first hear about this problem,
you
look at yourself and say, no, this can't be. No, this isn't true. But, yeah, it's true.
Well, on that note, I guess we'll wrap this segment up. Thank you, John, and thank you, Andrea, for joining us tonight. And thank you to the CrimeWire team and public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Tune in to our show next week as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers, seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guest. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. or hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume of your computer and the show will automatically play.
And remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there's nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the CrimeWire team. Vito Colucci, Denny Griffin, Donna Pendergast, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.